Welcome to episode 7 of Techish Podcast, featuring myself, Abadesi.
And Michael Behane. We're back.
Hey, Michael. Episode 7.
Yeah, what's going on?
We're
how
gonna
you been?
We're going to be in double digits soon.
Oh, my God.
I'm so excited.
Where's the time going?
Yeah, I've been good, thank you. How about you?
I've been all right, yeah.
I ate too many Easter eggs, actually. I'm not joking. I think I ate, like, one of the giant ones.
Oh, Lord.
Fully on my own. And then, like, the mini ones that came inside it as well, which... it's not good.
Was this in a group setting or were you by yourself?
I was alone, sad and alone in a dark corner. No, I'm joking. But no, it was good. It was good to have time off, to be honest.
Oh, so you were off work, right? You weren't working yesterday?
Oh, well, I had to do a bit of work on Sunday, actually. But generally speaking, theoretically, it was nice to have time off.
Yeah.
How about you?
Yeah, I've been all right. Nothing major. No time off for me.
No rest for the weekend.
Life of a founder type thing. But yeah.
A lot of stuff going on in the tech world these last weeks and in the world in general, really.
Yeah, it's been crazy, really. So much to tackle, I don't even know where to start.
Okay. I'm gonna let you start though. You tell me, what should we start with?
Should we just dive into winners and losers?
Let's go for it.
Alright, cool. We need to come up with like a segue music later where it's like winners and losers. One time I'm gonna make that. Everybody stay posted, that's coming. Okay, cool. So the first, I guess we're gonna have to start with a loser, bit of bad news. It's Ship goes out of business, which was essentially on-demand shipping company. I don't know if they would be happy with that description, but essentially that's what it was. They were
yeah,
trying to Uberize.
Really, really popular in SF. Yeah.
And the founder came out with an op-ed saying, listen, we went out of business, and it was entitled, I Can't Wait to See What You Do Next, which was quite a funny title. It's based on the fact that every time he told people that we're shutting down, all his investors, employees were kind of like, I can't wait to see what you do next. So it's quite a good title. So he wrote this really honest op-ed on Medium, and I read it on LinkedIn. Essentially breaking down why they went bust and why it didn't work. They couldn't really, they tried to pivot. Originally they were consumer focused, then they went to business focused, which was seemingly more profitable or at least more of a viable business. I don't think they ever really achieved profitability.
Yeah.
And it came too little too late, really. The pivot came too little too late, and I don't think the investors were willing to back them. He claims that, you know, they just run out of money, but I guess essentially nobody was willing to back their new vision. And they were incredibly popular at one point, like you said. What do you know about Ship?
Well, I know that, I mean, Product Hunt, AngelList, a company I work for, although these views are my own.
Yes, I have to say that.
Use Ship religiously, or, you know, did. And I think this is such a stark reminder of the challenge of doing a logistics business.
Yeah.
So if we, like, rewind our memories to when, like, food delivery started getting big in London. Obviously, there's Deliveroo, which is still here today. But then there was like an offshoot of all these other food delivery companies, you know, while it was hot. Yeah. VCs had the cash to splash and were just like throwing it all into these new startups. None of them have survived.
Yeah.
Hardly any of them have survived. And I think if you look at logistics, you know, in terms of deliveries, we see the same thing. Like, really, globally, and then even in the West, US and UK, there's only like a handful of delivery companies that really own the space. And I don't even know how profitable they are. You know, we talk about Amazon on the show a lot. Amazon don't make profit. They have a very
They are profitable, but it's a very small profitability.
Yes,
compared
that's it.
To what they could make, hypothetically speaking.
Because they're constantly reinvesting into stuff, and the logistics network and efficiencies in the logistics network is one of the big things that they put money into. So it's really interesting to see this happen, and I don't really know then what that says for other startups or founders like trying to get into some type of logistics business.
I think my concern is, you're right, logistics is a hard business to do.
It's just unit economics.
Exactly. So what does it say when a company hasn't got its unit economics right? So essentially they're not profitable per transaction when we say unit economics is not right. And yet they've been funded to the hilt. I'm not going to quote a number, I don't know, but it was a lot of money. And VCs poured it all in and they hadn't even figured out the model right.
Yes.
And somebody who isn't a funded founder, I look upon that and I say, is that wise? Because... you know, you might get the 1 in 100 that works, the Facebook.
Yes.
And that will create a gigantic company that spins out economies in itself, you know, social media agencies, blah, 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 blah. But is this healthy for an industry? Or is it a necessary part of capitalism, the VC model, where we just pour money into companies that haven't necessarily worked out, you know?
I will say one thing. He is a very talented founder, you know, to the point where he's writing this, why we failed. You know, normally it's
which
why
I love.
We failed.
I think this should be recommended reading at, like, business schools and like universities where you're studying to be an entrepreneur or whatever, because I learned a lot, to be honest, just reading it, like the pitfalls that can happen where you go all into a certain segment of your market, and you know, you don't figure out how to make it work, and you try to pivot, and sometimes it's too late. Your runway is gone, essentially.
Well, I think, you know, I have like two thoughts on this. Like, one is when you are an incredibly charismatic and talented founder who, you know, builds a successful team and builds a successful community around your product, it will not be difficult for you to find funding. Even if your numbers aren't quite hitting where they should be, it won't be difficult for you to tell that story again and convince people to keep believing in you and effectively extend your runway longer and longer and longer. And it seems like that was definitely the case here. And another thing that I know that he did was relating to unprofitable products which were loved by the community. Like, in part of this, you know, write-up, he's basically like, look, I also made a decision as CEO to keep investing resources into parts of the business which were not good for growth and profit, but which the community loved. And now I realize that that was a mistake. And I think that is like another interesting cautionary tale for like entrepreneurs in general. Like, what happens when the people that have been there since early days and got you to where you were, their interests don't necessarily align with the long term of your business? And I think every single company must go through that. And I don't know how to answer that question. You know, it's thankfully difficult. I'm not there yet, but it must be so hard when there are people that have been with you since day dot. But it just gets to this point in your timeline where you're like, we cannot continue to serve you guys in a way that makes sense for the business. You cut them off?
Yeah. It's a slight tangent I'm going to go on. I'm going to shout out Ruth, who was my co-founder at Pocket, because we kind of run a community-based business. And she did a talk where the first slide was that the community is not your friend. And what she meant by that is not necessarily that you and the community have like an antagonistic relationship. It's just that sometimes your interests don't always align, and sometimes they will hold you accountable to a way that your friends will not hold you accountable, for example. So you might make a mistake in your, you know, whatever your product may be or the direction you want to go into, and your community will let you know. This is slightly different in a sense where, you know, like you said, they were trying to, their community wanted them to carry on with a service that wasn't profitable to the company. So you're right, what do you do? I mean, is this just a downside of having, you know, a business where it's that well loved as a, how do I say, where it's not just a, you know, an in and out service. It's kind of like people kind of really are enamored by the brand.
Yeah.
Like, is that a downside to a certain extent then?
I think.
Or can it be a downside?
I think this shows that it can be a downside, particularly when you're operating in a space where, you know, profit margins are very, very low just by the nature of the business. You know what I mean? And we already know that logistics is you know, knife edge of like success or failure. So probably it just means that the margin for error is much smaller. I think that another thing that's probably happened here is when you start a business where one of the biggest reasons why people come to you is cost, you don't necessarily have the most loyal types of customers. And there's like a lot of really interesting like market research out there on this. I used to work at Groupon.
Yeah.
And we used to always talk about like, you know, the different personas of Groupon customers when we were doing any marketing projects. And it was there that I learned that when you do anything with regards to, let's say, like discounts or cheap stuff, the earliest adopters are the constant deal hunters. Like, that is a specific profile of a person. Yeah. They're the people that are on Hot UK Deals and like all these kind of websites. And they're always looking for the lowest
price.
Lowest price, exactly.
So let me ask you a question.
Those are also the same people that the minute you raise your prices,
they're like, what the hell is going
jog on?
So I want to ask you a question. Do you consider it to be almost like false economics where you've got a service? So Shipt, for example, they did innovate in terms of the user experience. So it's not just a cheap thing.
Of course.
But at the same time, because they're not profitable, essentially the business is subsidizing its service to users to give them a really affordable experience. So is that false economics? Are we saying what growth isn't really sustainable? It's not, these are not real businesses per se. Even Uber, for example, is not profitable whatsoever. And UberX is dirt cheap. And are these businesses sustainable? Is it false economics?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't really know what you mean by false economics.
In the sense that like these are not real units of economic engine. These are just subsidies to the consumer. Like, and we lap it up and we say, oh, I love the service.
Are we creating real growth?
Like, are we creating real businesses here? Yeah.
Stuff like that. Yeah. I think that's really interesting.
Take away the VC money. Is it all just going to disappear? And we're going to say, what happened to the service that I love?
I mean, absolutely. Venture capital creates like unsustainable businesses that do appear to be growing. We talk a lot about vanity metrics in this industry. There is a hell of a lot of vanity metrics going on out there where people are growing whatever interesting KPI, but probably in reality aren't necessarily creating real value.
Yeah, so is that a yes or a no? False economics, you don't want to say.
I need a clearer definition of false economics.
True. I've just created a term now. Like, this is a Michael Behan definition dictionary here. Like, and I'm saying, go on, do you agree? Yeah, I think it may be. I mean, it's difficult because I've seen a debate between Eric Ries of the Lean Startup
and
David Hennemeyer Hansen of Basecamp. And DHH, as he's known, he was quite a proponent of like just bootstrap and this whole like pour in the money and it's not profitable. It's complete BS as far as he was concerned. Whereas Eric Ries was like, listen, for example, Facebook, the way he put it is that, for example, like Facebook, it's, even though it wasn't profitable, we knew that essentially they were mining for gold and there was gold under the ground, which is user attention, which of a billion eyeballs, essentially.
Yes.
So it needs the funding, just like, for example, a mining operation to be unprofitable. And then eventually, once we hit the pay dirt, boom. So that's a good example. That's a good argument. I can't necessarily argue against it. Maybe that is right. And that 1 in 100 mine, air quotes, startup may be worth all of this pain and misery where everyone's losing their jobs and like having to start from scratch again. I don't know. We'll leave it at that. I don't think we've got the answers, keeping it real.
What? Sorry, just go back to that tangent. So, who's losing their jobs?
The employees at Ship.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
I'm saying it's turmoil. Like, if your company goes out of business.
Yes.
And it happens quite often where, you know, all the food startups.
Yes.
You know, so there's a lot of human energy and capital goes into that. Like, to start a new job, new career, for example. And then Ship was around for a while, but a lot of these food startups that you might mention, they might have a 2-3 year life cycle. But maybe that's the price we pay for, like, you know, innovation and dynamism and whatnot.
I think it is. And I think, like, one thing I'll say as someone that's, like, worked in tech for a long time is that I don't think people come into startups for security. You know what I mean? Like, you can go join the Tesco grad scheme.
We're coming to get rich. We're coming to get this money.
But, like, seriously, and it happens so often that startups fail and, you know, you meet, like, oh, I'm an ex, whatever. And it's just
it is what it is, isn't it?
And I think that shouldn't discourage people from like, joining the industry. And, you know, you always have a story to tell. And sometimes coming from a failed startup is even more interesting because people want to know,
you know,
what happened there and, like, what you learned.
Yeah, so I'm reading Anti-Fragile. I told you, like, off mic one time. And he has a section, the author, Nassim Taleb. He's talking about how there should be National Entrepreneur Day, which I don't agree with. But he says, like, even the failed entrepreneurs teach us what not to do. So these are technically, in his mind, heroes also. I don't think this is true. This is, like, grandiose.
It's a stretch.
But in a sense that most entrepreneurs will fail.
Yes.
And we know that, okay? And people that try, they teach us what works and what doesn't work.
Yes.
So in a sense, we should laud them even if they fail, which is quite a flip because in the UK, if you're a failure in the entrepreneurial sense, which is like, oh, whatever, your restaurant didn't work, get out of it, you're a bum type thing.
Maybe different. Kitchen nightmares.
Yeah, basically. Maybe different in the States. So just an interesting thought. I don't know. Just throwing it out there.
Okay. Table it.
Yeah, basically.
We'll just bring the Prime Minister on next time, Theresa May, if you're listening.
I would have a few more things to ask.
Okay, let's talk about Grindr sharing data around users who have HIV with third parties.
So BuzzFeed did an investigation, from what I know, and they looked into the data that the Grindr app, which is like widely popular, like you said, and they were sharing HIV status, location, and user profile information to all these third-party apps that are used by a lot of other companies, for example, to like optimize your software, for example.
Yes, they conduct A/B testing and other things, correct. UI like consultation.
But Grindr was like, they were slipping. Essentially, they were sharing it in like plain text form. Anybody who's a decent hacker could intercept the data and figure out like who you are, where you are, and where your HIV status is. And I mean, to be honest, okay, the security is terrible, but if you're living in a country where it's frowned upon to be gay, that shit is life or death to a certain extent.
Of course.
So it's just another example of like we're just entrusting too much data with these software companies and they're not looking after us. Like I feel like the tide is turning now where everyone's kind of like, hold on, this ain't on anymore.
Exactly.
And we kind of went into this blindly, you know, the new economy, the new future, everything's going to be wonderful. Yes. Tech will save the world. And now we're kind of like, slow down, guys. What are you doing?
I'm reading those terms and conditions with every software update.
Because you know we all just click that. You know we all just click that.
Let me print this. Save us PDF. I think you're right to point out the fact that it's not even about whether or not you have the rights to use my data. It's I need to hold you, tech company, accountable to how you use that data and even how you send that data. Because like you said, they're not using this data to sell it to anyone else. They're actually just using this data to optimize the experience of the app for specific users.
Yeah.
But they did not encrypt it when they sent it to these companies.
They didn't. And Grindr's actually come out and they've been quite defensive, to be honest. They've been like, it's a witch hunt. They haven't actually like held their hands up, which I think is a mistake. If you effed up, you effed up. Like, don't do what Mark Zuckerberg did and you know, kind
go
of
go into hiding.
Yeah, go into hiding and then come out later on 3 weeks with a tail beneath your leg saying, okay, we got it wrong. Sorry. Like, just come out straight away and own it. Like, you messed up. Like,
But that's where I feel that there's such a big gap between, like, corporate speak and just, like, authentic human connection. And it's like, you know, on an individual level, it's like, yes, it just makes sense. You've messed up. Put your hands up. Say you're sorry. I'll respect you for it. Move on.
Yeah.
But then what happens with these big companies is they have all these, like, big PR experts and communications consultancies. And, like, 100%, I bet you that, like, Mark Zuckerberg was, like, locked in a room when Cambridge Analytica broke, and they were like, don't touch mobile devices, do not go on social media, we need to strategize, we need to make an action plan. Went into, like, Code Red, boom, 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 and then, like, whoever, the head of this, you know, PR expert firm was just like, this is our plan.
In Mark, sorry to make this about Zuckerberg again, but the problem with him is that when the initial hoopla came up about the election, he came out with an off-the-cuff statement saying, oh, it's silly to think that Facebook can impact elections. But then his marketing team got and his sales team got him in the room and said, what the hell are you you can't say that because our whole mandate is to say that we can impact elections using our ad product. So his off-the-cuff remark basically contradicted their whole business model. So that's probably why he's like, okay, let's just like hide and think what we're going to say carefully. So sometimes it is warranted if your founder is going to come out and say something stupid as that, to be brutally honest.
Yeah, but I like knowing that founders aren't like perfect people and that they're not infallible people and neither are companies.
But shareholders don't. Yeah, that's true. Shareholders don't.
Look at the room.
Yeah, they're like, yeah, well, we like you can't say that. Like, but with Grindr, yeah, they seem to have gone on the defensive.
So there have been some really interesting like follow-on articles, which if you find this interesting, like I encourage you to read, just around the type of information dating apps have on you. And I find this super interesting because I have a lot of single friends and, you know, they're like swiping away on like Tinder or, you know, whatever the other ones are.
Bumble,
I'm so out of the game.
I'm out of the game as well.
But anyway, what this, you know, what I've been reading about is how much you can know about a person from having access to their dating profile. You know about, you know, how often they go out, you know, whether they like to drink or take drugs. You even know more about them based on how they interact with other people in the dating app. So you start messaging people in the dating app. Now I can see how you message. I might even know what your fetishes are, what your kinks are. I know where you've been because it's location tracking. I know what kind of people you're interested in, either their ethnicity, their age, whatever. And I don't think people are fully mindful of how much of a profile that these dating apps can build, because it's quite an innocent premise, really. Like, oh, we'll help you find love. Who doesn't want to fall in love and, you know, not be lonely anymore? But you're sharing all of this stuff through these interactions.
The most interesting book actually I read the last like 1 or 2 years is called Dataclysm, and it was about that. It's the founder of OkCupid. And he had a lot of anonymized data. Obviously, it wasn't like specific to an individual, but he looked at like people's dating habits. He could even break down like what were people's racial preferences and actually break down like what racial groups weren't getting as much love as others, for example. Like, I'd recommend everybody read it. It's bloody fascinating. Like, and the type of things where, yeah, it's just crazy, like, how much they actually know. That book was framed in a way where it wasn't about, we know so much about you individually. It was about, we know as a collective, using, like, a lot of the modern-day data science techniques about the collective as a whole. But it's still frightening. I'm still like, wow, the fact that they know this, like, and even, like, the most commonly used phrase by each individual racial group or gender or, like, like, they can look at messages and, like, what ages that, like, so, for example, this is one example, and it's slightly a cheeky one, but, like, they realize that women generally like men that are in the same age cohort as them. So a 28-year-old woman would like a 28-year-old, 30, for example. Whereas men, they stay stuck at 21. So if a man is 40, his still favorite like profile to look at is 21. Even up to the age of like 45. It's crazy. Like,
wow, patriarchy alive and well.
Real talk. And to be honest, like, but the reason why I found the data so fascinating is because it's not what people say. This is their real life behavior. This is like that you can't. You can't BS this kind of thing. Like, you just can't hide this kind of thing. And it says a lot about the human psyche.
That's super interesting, you know.
You should really read it. You might impress you, but it's really like...
What was the name of the book again?
Dataclysm. And the guy's called Christian Rudder.
Okay, cool.
As in, it's like, this is the founder of OkCupid, one of the most popular dating sites of all time. And he's just gone behind the scenes and said, this is what we know about human beings and their behavior when they think nobody's looking.
Yeah.
And it's crazy, like...
Go
on, sorry, go on, take the floor.
No, you say it. What were you going to say? You love what?
Like, they can even tell when there are people that are just doing cut and paste messages. Like, You can just see like there's one, like when somebody is like, they have a graph and you'll see people that how many words they type per message.
Yeah.
And then you see one person, like there'll be a constant small skew where they're typing one word and like, what does that mean? It's people that are just cutting and pasting every single message, same one.
Oh my God.
Normally dudes, and just a complete spray and pray tactic where they're like, let me just message 1,000 profiles. Like,
oh my God.
Yeah, but the shit is fascinating.
I actually met someone at a house party once, a lady, and she had saved in her iPhone notes this message, which was like, if I could rearrange the alphabet, I'd put you and I together. I'm not joking.
But how hard is that to remember that? It's not even that deep.
Yeah, I know, it wasn't even that deep.
I was thinking you were going to say something crazy.
She would just like copy and paste that into every message, which I find frightening. Yeah, it's crazy. It's so interesting what you, like, one of the things I picked up as you were talking was this idea of like, where are we our truest selves? Because even though we have a lot of our own data on, you know, social media, Instagram or whatever, there aren't really that many platforms where we're our true selves, right? So like even Twitter, I'm a prolific Twitter user. I'm on it a lot. I use it a lot for work. I don't share everything about myself. I share the things which are like amusing.
That's a controlled image.
Exactly. It's a controlled image. And then we have Instagram, AKA the highlights reel, right? That's like the life we wish we lived daily, but in reality live like, you know, when we're on holiday. Or it's the life we
want everybody to think that we're living.
Exactly. But then when it comes to dating, obviously, if I fake it too much there, I'm only going to be disappointed because I know what I like and I know what I'm attracted to.
But then,
so maybe it could be that some dating apps have the truest versions of us.
It has the truest versions of us, but also has the false version of us because we have the idealized self that we project to other profiles.
Oh, yeah, like, I'm 6'5".
Exactly, right? Or I like, you know, classical music when you know very well that you don't. When I was on Tinder, I used to see sapiosexual in every flipping comment. Like, everyone was a sapiosexual, apparently.
What's sapiosexual? That you're
strictly attracted to intelligence only. As in, you don't care. It's complete BS.
Come
I'm sorry,
now.
Like, guys.
Come on.
Maybe that's 1% of the population, but it couldn't have been as many as that before. But this is during my single days. I love you to my girlfriend. Anyways, like.
Were you saw guys with that or girls
with
that?
No, it's mainly girls.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah, intellectual, yeah.
So my point I was making is that your online profile for dating has your fake version. But under the hood, what the companies are able to see are your truest desires, which isn't...
Because they know what you're matching
exactly. Yeah, yeah, they know exactly what you're searching for. They know exactly who you're messaging. They know exactly how often you're messaging them, you know, and it's fascinating. I definitely recommend everybody get that book.
There's a really good episode in the latest season of Black Mirror around dating app algorithms. Did you watch that one?
I have never seen any episodes of Black Mirror.
Oh my
You always say this
God.
To me every episode. Like in episode one, you disown me, but I still... I just have, there's too many shows to stream. What can I do?
It's like so good. It's basically like watching documentaries before that reality has happened. It's amazing. But anyway, I won't spoil it for you then. Another time.
All right, cool.
Okay, next winner.
Next winner or loser. I'm losing track of who the winners or the losers are. I feel like every time we do this, it's just all losers. Anyways, so trouble in big tech again.
Oh, big tech.
So,
who's it now? Google?
No.
Facebook?
It's Apple. Our buddies Amazon.
Oh, Amazon.
Who I just used this morning, actually. So, man like DT, Donald Trump, has come out and he's attacked Amazon, or Jeff Bezos specifically. And
has he said they're too huge?
They're too huge. Yeah, he said they're too big and that they're ripping off the US Postal Service and that they need to have a deal renegotiated with the Postal Service.
Why now?
So, those in the know are basically saying that Jeff Bezos purchased the Washington Post, which was like quite a famous newspaper.
Yeah,
that was some time ago, before
Trump came into power.
And the Washington Post are doing a lot of investigative work into Trump and his shenanigans.
Mm.
So Trump views it as a political weapon against him. So he's using everything at his disposal to get back at Jeff Bezos. It's a real soap opera.
Tit for tat.
Literally. And he's using anything at his disposal. So he's working on the angle saying the Postal Service is getting ripped off. They need to renegotiate a better deal with Amazon. And in fact, Trump's aides in his inner circle have come out and said, actually, the Postal Service is benefiting from Amazon because nobody sends letters anymore. We all send email. So that Amazon is actually allowing the Postal Service to be profitable and subsidizing for the rest of the consumers who are just sending letters. Otherwise, it would be much more expensive.
Interesting.
So it's complete BS on Trump's behalf. My favorite part, though, is that the former CEO of Walmart has come out backing Trump, saying that Amazon is destroying small business.
Oh my God,
if
the
you know
irony.
Anything about Walmart, yeah, the history of Walmart, yeah, the irony of that statement, it's not even irony, hypocrisy, I'm not irony, I'm using it in the incorrect sense. It's just absolute hypocrisy. Like, so I'm no, like, defender of big tech, but I do feel like Amazon is getting ganged up upon. for political reasons, and the Walmart CEO thing is just complete. Just
Walmart, like, literally destroyed, like, the high street.
So
in
many
the
towns,
US, and they're they expanded globally.
So many towns, they ripped up like all
fingers
the,
in every market.
Pretty much, like, so yeah, I don't even know what take to take.
He'll
like,
just be a mouthpiece, though, won't he? This Bill Simon guy joining Trump. Trump probably promised him a few free games of golf or something.
Pretty much. And now the stock's dipped 5%, although we talk about stock dips all the time. I'm sure it will recover. But it's just like... Oh, that's my phone. That's my watch. it's like, what do you take from it? Does a company get so big that eventually the only enemies they have left are the political ones? Like, this company is now so big that no company can test Amazon. There's not a retailer out there that can go toe-to-toe with these guys. So the only, you know, foe they have now is governments, which is crazy.
I feel like I have, like, a few views on this, because on the one hand, which we've spoken about before, we do need to start having conversations as a society around how big we want tech companies to get. Because there is undeniably, like, some types of monopolization happening with all these big tech giants that we talk about. And, you know, maybe it's not as visible because the things that they do are like software are invisible to us or whatever. But the fact is, like you say, they do inhibit competition. Mm. And then that does mean that they're potentially fixing prices. Now, so far, these people have kept prices like relatively low or like free. Mm. So we're not feeling it. But if at any moment Amazon just decides to 2x its prices, I mean, it wouldn't do that, but it could.
Mm. And there'd be no reprieve.
Exactly. So really? I think it's very important for us to have a conversation around it. But what frustrates me about this is that I don't feel that the conversation is happening for the right reasons.
Of course not.
I feel that in this specific example, we all know that POTUS doesn't like there to be anything critical or negative about him at all. And he'll use like the whole weight of his like influence and power to stop that. And that's just sad.
You swayed me though, because when we had this first conversation about breaking up companies, you basically said to me that if it's good for the consumer, it shouldn't be broken up. So at this current stage, Amazon is good for the consumer. We need to monitor that. That may change.
Mm.
So in a traditional situation where a company's broken up, it's when they're ripping off the consumer and there's no one to stop them from doing so.
Yeah.
And in this situation, everybody loves Amazon. I don't know anybody that hates Amazon apart from, you know, disgruntled competitors or disgruntled maybe former employees, for example.
Yeah.
But apart from that, everybody loves that shit. So I don't know, should they be broken up?
But I was reading about like cognitive dissonance the other day.
Go on. Dropping knowledge.
And like cognitive dissonance, it's like, I'm not even going to
give you the definition.
I'm looking it up because I don't want to mess this up.
Go on.
It's the state of having inconsistent thoughts, beliefs, or attitudes.
At the same time.
Yes, especially as relating to behavioral decisions and attitude change. So basically, it's this idea in psychology that you can basically have two completely opposing opinions and believe them equally strongly. And like what I would say about myself in relation to like Amazon and big tech is that I like Amazon as a consumer, but I don't like all of Amazon's practices as a citizen of the world.
Mm.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because like on the one hand, like, you know, I do care about sustainability and I do care about healthy competition, and I do care about the fact that the gap between the richest and the poorest in the world is accelerating quicker than it ever has, and I don't like that concerns me. Amazon contributes to all of those things.
They do
in some way, but yes, Amazon is cheap and convenient and I use it. So there's this, I'm conscious of this cognitive dissonance
I don't think it's cognitive dissonance. I think it's hypocrisy. She just pulled her arms. I'm joking.
Obviously, I am pulling. No,
I'm in the same boat as well.
I'll take it.
I loved a lot of companies that I know are, you know, they're bad actors.
Yeah.
I love Uber. I'm keeping it real. I never deleted Uber. I didn't do it, guys. I'm sorry. That shit is cheap and convenient.
Man's gotta get home.
Yeah, I gotta get home. Man's gotta get home. And it's the best way to get home. But I know that they're not great actors.
Mm.
And they've had CEO or the founder who wasn't the best guy in the world.
No.
So I don't put it down to cognitive dissonance. I'm aware of both facts and I just choose to ignore one because I'm like, it benefits me.
Yes.
And in aggregate, we all do it. There might be a few of you who are conscious objectors, but most of us do it. And, you know, maybe that is when the government steps in, because to be honest, us as consumers are not willing or able to shift the markets in that way.
Yeah.
To give the outcome that we think is beneficial for all of us as a total. The wealth inequality thing, where do we stop though? Do we break up every single company over a certain market cap?
This is the thing though,
because you can make, okay, I'll put on my free market capitalist hat on, okay?
You're always wearing that hat.
What are you talking about? I'm the communist one. What are you talking about? My free market capitalist hat on. Okay. Mm-hmm. If a company is making their prices dirt cheap, essentially, that's a pay rise to somebody who is on a struggling wage. So I'll picture my mum 10, 15 years ago working in, you know, single mum working in a retail store. If all her goods automatically are 30% cheaper that she purchases, to a certain extent, her pay's gone up, essentially.
She can afford more.
She can afford more, which is in the equivalent of a pay rise to a certain extent. So where do we draw the line? I don't know. That's what I'm saying. As a consumer, we all benefit from Amazon. But you're right. Yeah, maybe it is cognitive dissonance because I'm confused. I don't know the answer. Like, it's one of those things where I have no, either way, I'm open to all possibilities. I don't think the status quo probably is acceptable.
I think like having the cost of goods in your basket of things that you consume every month, whatever, going down will make you feel, quotation marked, richer. Yeah. Like all things being equal. But I don't think...
At what cost?
Well, this is the thing. Economics puns. Yeah. But I also think that, well, like there's this really good book that came out a while back by Thomas Piketty called Capital, which I still haven't finished reading.
I didn't even try.
It's so long. But then I just listened to some podcasts, read the articles, and what he's basically saying is like, you need... That's just like one element of like wealth. And like what you really need are like things which like are assets capital, which is accruing wealth. And that's what makes you rich. And when we have all these big tech companies, you know, who benefits the most from Amazon? Like, honestly, guys, it's not us. It's the people that own Amazon shares. So it's Jeff Bezos, who's a billionaire, and like all the other dudes, where Amazon is just like one of the many companies like in their portfolio. Yeah. You know, these are the private jet people. So far removed from us that we don't even know. And I think sometimes we forget that. So if breaking up these companies makes them less rich and gives more of that to us somehow, I'm for it. I'm all for it. You know, that's how I feel.
You know, I'd recommend everybody check out Scott Galloway because he's the guy who's the most prominent person that I see out there that's pushing the narrative of break up these companies. And he says, you know, if Amazon and AWS are separate companies, or, you know, Facebook, WhatsApp and Instagram are all separate companies, we'd be living in a world where you'd have more millionaires and less billionaires. Well, right now we live in the inverse, which is that it's easy to become a billionaire, but there's less chance of the average person becoming a millionaire.
Yes.
So I agree. Despite all I've said, I do think there needs to be some kind of action.
I think what we need to start to maybe scrutinize more is, you know, who really makes these big decisions and who really like holds the power. Like, let's keep a close eye on this Donald Trump Amazon debate, because, you know, if Amazon falls, then the rest will follow, right? Because the way the legal system works is all on precedent. Mm. So that's why, like, before anything has ever happened, it's very unlikely to happen, because once you make that decision, like once someone decides, yes, Amazon is too big, let's break it up, all the rest will follow like dominoes, because suddenly there'll be a case for all the other companies to do it. So, you know, potentially a groundbreaking moment in our times if something happens with it. But
the irony is that both of us basically despise Trump, but here he's playing a role that technically we both kind of agree with, and it says that there's some kind of pushback on Amazon. Would that be a fair assessment?
We spent the whole time
saying that we don't like Trump, which is how we started off, and now we're saying that, to be honest, there needs to be some government pushback against Amazon, and it's taken the form of Trump doing it for his own self-interest.
Wow.
And it's ending up actually having an impact that both of us that are quite progressive would actually like to see happen, which is ironic. I don't know. It's a weird state of affairs.
That's so weird.
I don't know who to root for.
I feel confused.
Because the last company that was actually a tech company that had pushback from the government was Microsoft back in the 90s. So they released Internet Explorer. And at the time, what was the original browser? Netscape. They had a paid for browser. If you're too young to remember, you actually had to pay for browsers.
You don't even remember.
I remember. I was there.
You used Netscape?
I didn't use Netscape, but I never had the internet until quite later on, but I had a computer. Okay, anyways, cool. I digress.
Sorry.
So Netscape was a paid for browser. You had to pay to use Netscape, which was a browser. So Microsoft, because Windows was so dominant, was like, we're just going to give away Internet Explorer for free embedded into Windows, which is like anti-competitive. They completely destroyed Netscape's business model. So the government was like, you guys are too big, you can't keep doing this. So they put Bill Gates in a hearing, and they questioned him and whatever. There's footage out there, and you can see Bill look flustered for the first time in your life. But the reason why I bring it up is that Microsoft lost their monopoly not through that action. They lost their monopoly because they missed the smartphone. So could you say that in the due process of time,
yes,
the companies that are now the big boys that are dominant, eventually they will dissipate anyway. That's what's happened. If I look at the top 20 companies, yes, 20, 30 years ago, it's not the same at all.
Yes.
So, or are we now saying it's a different time now where, because of the network effects of the internet, mm, these guys will never fall? I don't know.
Well, I mean, like, I guess that depends on how the next wave of technology will infiltrate our daily lives as consumers and individuals. Because, like you say, you know, one of the, other than Apple, when we think of like the highest market cap companies in like US stock market, which is like the biggest, especially like for tech, they're all software companies.
Mm.
So, you know, Microsoft was like hardware and like an incredible operating system. And basically,
it wasn't hardware.
What did they not?
They just gave away Windows and it was like Dell and all the other PCs.
Shit, that's it.
Yeah.
But like they had great penetration in like B2B space and stuff
basically,
like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
They
just dominated PCs. They owned PCs basically.
Yes.
Even though they didn't own the PC, they owned the PC as the actual hardware because these guys were just like cheap.
And then like
PCs and they owned all of it.
And then the next wave was like personal computing, right? And like, you know, that's what Steve Jobs predicted. He predicted that people would, you know, get tired of Discmans and Walkman and want to have like more songs in their pocket, 10,000 songs in their pocket. And
personal
then,
devices, basically.
Yeah, personal devices, exactly. Now, let's see, is it going to be smart home? Is it going to be one of the many applications of AI, natural language processing? Like, I don't know, we don't know, but someone could come in and be that person.
I'll play devil's advocate why it might not happen is because in order for you to use AI and to use like a lot of the modern data science techniques, you need access to a lot of data to run the models. And who owns all the data? The big companies. So if AI is the next wave, which we all think it is, nobody has a bigger head start than these guys.
That's true.
So it's difficult to predict. Unless it's like VR or AR or something that we have yet to foresee in quantum computing, I don't know. So it's difficult to know where they will fall unless it's some kind of just direct incompetence.
Maybe it will look more like partnerships. So, for example, like DeepMind is working with NHS.
Yeah,
to like
but DeepMind is owned by Google now.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that.
And that's the problem. Whenever there's somebody promising, they just acquire them. Mm. So I thought in my head, okay, maybe we should stop these companies from acquiring companies. But then you ruin the incentive for VCs to fund companies to get exits.
Exactly.
So it's like, what do you do? Because then it trickles down to the founder who's trying to start a company. They're not gonna raise money if the big four are out of the option to acquire their company. So there's so many cascading effects here that it's so complicated. It's beyond anybody's like way to comprehend. Like whatever we do, or that does happen, there will be unintended consequences.
Of course.
That unfortunately, and a lot of times it just ends up trickling down and hurting the small little guy, keeping it real.
Yeah, well, the problem is it doesn't trickle down. At least the money doesn't.
Yeah.
The money doesn't trickle down and that's...
But whatever policy is enacted...
Mm.
You know, does it end up helping the little person? I don't know.
Okay. Who's next in the firing line?
We brought up Apple. So the CEO of Apple, Tim Cook, has come out and he's completely fired shots at Facebook. So I'll read the quote. I'll get it right.
It's not been a good month for Facebook.
Yeah, it hasn't been. So you know Facebook's been in trouble with all this hoopla, with the data leaks and whatnot. So Tim Cook, CEO of Apple, said, "The ability of anybody to know what you've been browsing about for years, who your contacts are, who their contacts are, things that you like and dislike, and every intimate detail of your life, from my point of view, it shouldn't exist."
What?
He's like, "I think the best regulation is no regulation, it's self-regulation. However, I think we're beyond that here.
Of course.
We could make, this is, and I'm compositing all these quotes from different interviews. This is another quote. We could have made a ton of money if we had monetized our customer, if our customer was our product. We've elected not to do that. Privacy to us is a human right." Okay, so the question I pose, is this a truly philosophical differences between two companies, or is this just the rival company just kicking another company when it's down, or is it both?
I mean, that's, what about Siri? That's the first thing that comes to mind. What about Siri? I know my iPhone is listening to me. This is why I keep my iPhone on airplane mode all the time, or on low battery mode, because if you say, "Hey Siri, ding ding, what do you want?" right? And the only way that it can do that is if it's listening to me all the time.
Okay, so I would say that Siri probably is listening to you. But I think not that I work for Apple here, but I would say that they use Siri, they listen to you to improve Siri. So they collect all the data of everybody that's using Siri, and it makes Siri better, essentially, using machine learning and whatnot. Whereas the distinction with Facebook is they might listen to you or get your data to sell to third parties.
Yeah.
And that's the distinction, who you don't necessarily know much about. You might have co-signed Facebook because you're like, okay, I use Facebook, I trust Facebook. Mm-hmm. But you don't know about these third parties, Cambridge Analytica, et cetera, and what it's going to be used for.
Yeah.
Whereas Apple's saying, we sell you our device and we just want to make our device better.
But I mean, I guess it's like a spectrum and like a gray area of like where you draw the line, because ultimately they want to make the device better so that they can release another smartphone that costs $300 more than the last one and is like only whatever point something megapixel better camera.
But it's a devil's bargain. We all know what we're doing when we buy the phone.
But this is the thing, it's just
and I don't think we know what we're doing when we're on Facebook. I think that's the difference. I don't think most of us know what is going on in terms of how we're being monetized when we're on Facebook.
But I thought now we do know. Basically, everything you do is going to get shared and sold. That's it. That's the rule. It's not not rocket science. It's not complicated. You're doing something, it's a data point. Yeah. You're looking at something, it's a data point. You're liking something, it's a data point.
But could I explain that to my mum and dad? I don't know if I could. Or if I said to them, Apple wants to sell another phone that's more expensive, they'd be like, I get that. But does my mum and dad know, or auntie know that, you know, when they send that message or when they, you know, like that page about Eritrean music, that it means that they are now easily targeted for, you know, something benign like music or maybe something not benign like a political ad.
What about Apple Music? I mean, come on. I just feel that there is a bit of pot calling the kettle black going on here, because this idea of, you know, knowing what you like and what you don't like, personalization is the future of technology. As far as a consumer perspective goes, right? Like, I love Spotify because it has this incredible algorithm. People watch YouTube videos because it knows the next best thing to recommend. Netflix, you know, I'll go on and on and on. And especially if you're, like, in SaaS or whatever, like, you're trying to constantly, like, personalize the experience to the user or let the user create, like, a tailored experience. And the only way you can do that is by having information about what they like and what they don't like. You know, dating apps. We were just talking about dating apps. You know, he says that we're beyond that and that it shouldn't exist. I am very conscious of the fact that, like, we live in a world which is, like, dominated by, like, signaling. Like, this is bad and this is good. And, like, it smells a bit like a PR stunt is what I'm going to say.
I think it's definitely posturing. And it's definitely kicking them while they're down, because despite the fact, like, I mean, a few years ago, you never would have saw Apple as Facebook as rivals. But you just never really know. Like, I mean, Facebook tried to do, like, an operating system with Android at one point. Like, they tried to do, like, take over the Android OS. Yeah, at one point. It completely flopped.
Awkward.
But I think, like, most people now would acknowledge that, even though they don't directly compete, eventually they will. So, to me, it's an opponent kicking an opponent where they're down.
Yeah.
And a bit of posturing. I mean, Apple's always had to go on, like, they're the privacy kings. If you remember, like, the FBI wanted to break into an iPhone of a terrorist.
Yes, I remember.
And Apple refused. They were like, we're not going to do it. We're not going to create a backdoor. To an iPhone. The iPhone has to remain secure, otherwise we compromise all of our users' security.
I think I should fact check if they did. In the end, did they hold out on that?
No, in the end, the FBI found another way in.
Oh, yes, they hacked
it. The FBI found another way in. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm skeptical of Apple being, you know, the saviors of all our privacy. I don't know.
For me, I love Apple and I'm locked into the ecosystem, but, like, I feel like they should be more sustainable in their practices, like, with regards to, like, their carbon footprint and their whole manufacturing supply chain and everything like that.
Madness.
I mean, I just read another article about how they're going to start manufacturing their own chips now for Mac and whatever. And I was like, oh, they probably just, like, want a cheaper contract with a factory in China or something.
Probably,
like that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's not like, oh, we're going to, you know, do it in a way that's going to bring jobs back to the people who need it or pay a living wage or whatever.
Yeah, there are no saints in all these. They're all effing up in some way.
It's actually to the point where, different, like, sins. I've been thinking about navigating away from having an iPhone.
What are you thinking?
Just anything else, potentially. I don't know.
But saying all that, iPhone is, like, the most secure one. Like, the Android, there's not a lot of security on there.
What is the OnePlus? Have you heard good things about that?
No.
Okay, yeah. Well, anyway, there'll be another conversation.
It's hard to avoid, like, if you jump out of bed of Apple, you're jumping into the bed of Google. That's it. Like, there's no way you can avoid
Nokia,
which was owned by Microsoft at one point. I don't know the status of that anymore.
Ericsson? Does Ericsson still do mobiles? I don't think they do. I'm pretty sure they don't. So there's a really interesting quote from one of our favorite people in tech, Arlen Hamilton, founder of Backstage Capital. If you don't know her, please go follow her on Twitter and read all about the Backstage Capital story.
Yeah, they're awesome.
She's raised a massive fund and she's investing in underrepresented founders, women, people of color, LGBTQI, etc. And she's come out in the press, was this at South by Southwest?
Yeah.
Saying that she does not believe in unconscious bias. I'll read the full quote. I don't believe in unconscious bias anymore. It's all conscious bias, which we all have, by the way. Every one of us has bias. I am less interested in trying to teach a Facebook or a Google how to understand me or how to understand us than to enable someone in the room to create their own from the ground up. So I'm a little bit of a rebel in that way. They've had the cards for so long. It's time for us to get our own. The more time I spend with Venture and the older I get, the fewer fucks I give. I've actually
She's awesome. She's a bad man. Arlen, when she was here in London.
That's and so like, gangster. She is incredible. And
jealous that I never got to meet her, actually.
Your time will come.
One day.
we'll get her on the show. That'd be awesome.
Touch wood.
But I think I have so many feelings about this. Like, one, yes, like from the moment I wanted to start Hustle Crew, I have always believed in this idea of underrepresented groups making their own table. So everything that she says like resonates with me. But I feel like I've almost gone the other way than her as I've gotten like deeper into this journey and realized that power and influence are so concentrated in the majority groups, like in the status quo groups, that it will be so long to get the change we want unless we find a way to work with them. And also, yes, we all have bias, and you know, this thing around I don't believe in unconscious bias, I kind of agree partly with that, just in the sense that when there are things which make the status quo, the establishment, whatever you want to call them, feel uncomfortable, they get rebranded into another term. So like earlier, you're like, oh, there's no such thing as cognitive dissonance. That's just like being a hypocrite.
No. The concept that was valid. Churlish, but I mean, but like, yeah. The concept was valid, but I mean, in that context, I don't think it was appropriate.
But with like unconscious bias, for example, like it's become this umbrella term, which does often include just straight up racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, Islamophobia, or whatever. Or if you're like, oh, I have an unconscious bias. It's like, no, you just racist or sexist, Islamophobic, whatever. So I do agree with her that, you know, maybe unconscious bias as a movement is not serving the purpose that it was created to do, because it was supposed to be an easier way to talk about, you know, why aren't there more women in the room right now? Or why aren't there more people of color in the room right now? You know, we're a startup. We want to represent our customers, but we just don't. You know, it's made it too easy for people to go, oh, you know, we're trying. Let's build complicated technological solutions to fix it. Oh, it's still not working. Maybe it's about time we kind of just go, look, guys, it's broken. The system is broken. We are broken. And until we dredge up all this stuff, which are blockers, we're not really going to make progress.
But then what were you saying then? You're saying that you've gone in the opposite direction. So you think that we should try to engage and work with these companies, that it's not a lost cause, essentially.
So
two-pronged strategy, essentially, do you think?
So, yeah, basically, yes, right? So, you know, she's saying we need to enable someone in the room to create their own. Like, yes, I would love for the next Mark Zuckerberg to not look like Zuckerberg and not have had that same background. Or, you know, the next Collinson brothers to not look like the Collinson brothers. Who? And, again, the founders of Stripe.
Ah, okay, cool, yeah.
You know, I would love for that to be the case, but you know, like I've said in previous podcasts, I increasingly see the world from a position of, you know, how much power do I have compared to that guy over there or all the way up there and the power that they have. And it always feels like the people with the most power, typically money, then also have the most influence and the biggest ability to change things. And I'm not saying grassroots can't work, and I'm not saying there's no space for other people to rise up. But what I'm saying is, you know, it's going to take you a long, long time. And you've just been talking about the power of data and how much value data has. So, you know, for someone to create the next Facebook, like starting from ground zero, starting from nothing, there's a lot of leapfrogging to do. And that's my thought.
Yeah, I'm conflicted. I mean, don't get twisted, it's difficult to build your own. But when I look at like the previous, not to get all rah-rah, but if I look at the struggles that the previous generations had in terms of, you know, women or black people, it was just a struggle to be seen as a human being if you're looking at basically what our previous generations had to go through.
Of course.
So this is not insurmountable. So I completely agree with the ethos of what she's saying. But at the same time, I do recognize that building your next Facebook or Google, it's going to be bloody difficult. It's not easy. And I've struggled with what she's saying because, for example, pocketjobs.com essentially tries to help people get hired within the existing establishment, essentially. So I sometimes think, am I, you know, adding to the problem by saying that we can't create our own, we have to try to get hired within the existing companies? Or do I say, or do I have to say, you know what, these are the opportunities that exist right now, and we have to work with what's here? So I'm conflicted, to be honest. And I love the fact that she said this, because somebody had to say it, though. And it reminded me, so for example, Naomi Campbell came out, slight tangent. She was like, we need a Vogue Africa, because you know there's a Vogue Arabia. And at first I read that, I was like, yeah, we do need to invoke Africa. Then I'm like, why can't we just build our own? Why do we need to be co-signed by some Italian, I don't even know where Vogue's from, some European magazine that defines to us what beauty or what the standards are, kind of thing. And maybe that's what she's saying. We need a shift in mindset, think bigger. Like, why do we have to always try to get co-signed by what exists already? Why can't we just build our own? And I think...
But we can, and we can. Are. This is the thing, like...
But more of us need to think this way, because not everybody thinks this way. Because someone has no, like Naomi Campbell, okay, it's not tech. For her to be that established in the fashion industry, for her to not even conceive of the option.
Yes.
Like, so...
But that's a different... Look, she's a different generation. Like, true that. Not throwing shade. She's a beautiful woman, but, you know...
True that.
Look, we're here. We're entrepreneurs. There are other people around us who are entrepreneurs. There are more and more people doing their own thing. Like, there's an incredible, like, broadcaster and author, Emma Gannon, whose book comes out in May, The Multi-Hyphenate Method, in which she talks about millennials and Gen Zers who basically looked at the establishment and went, nah, not for me.
Yeah.
I'm going to do me. Mm. And that's great. But I think we also have to remember that, you know, she can say, oh, the Facebooks and the Googles. Look, these are names which are very highly recognized, but which are oddities and rarities. Mm. And we can't just have every single person from our communities going out and being entrepreneurs. Because at the end of the day, the only reason why Googles and Facebooks even exist is because, like, somewhere down the line are people who just did a normal job for a really long time, accrued a certain amount of wealth, and then could become investors and invest in these companies. And while we definitely need more entrepreneurs, we also just need more people who have money in our communities.
No, that's true.
And we do not have that. And
access the money to direct it, because you might be a VC who's backed by an LP.
You know, underrepresented LPs. Communities, like, disproportionately, you know, lack wealthy individuals, you know, for the same reasons why they're underrepresented in the first place. You know, there are these invisible systems of oppression working against us. And I just think, you know, there's also value in just sticking with something and creating wealth that way. But absolutely, like, you know, within tech, some people should consider doing their own thing, but I don't think everyone should. I think some people should also just, like, work their way up and then, like, make loads of money, like, sell valuable equity and then become investors and support their community that way.
But don't get twisted. I don't think she's saying that, you know, everyone should try and build their own Facebook or Google. But if those of us that do, I say us, but those that are able to do so, they would be able to hire. I mean, how many people does Facebook or Google hire? Thousands of people.
Hundreds of thousands.
Exactly. Total, like, yeah. So if those companies are led by people that are more quote-unquote woke, even though I hate that word, then all of a sudden the employment statistics are looking a bit different. So it's a knock-on effect. So
I'll say one thing.
It's a knock-on effect. And the two-pronged strategy is right. I think what you've said and what she said have to be combined in a sense that we do need people to engage with what's there, but we also need people that are going to, you know, work on building their own institutions and tables. And with that,
definitely,
eventually progress will happen. I hope so anyway. To leave it on a positive note.
I agree. And I would also, you know, just like to see more representation of people other than straight white guys on the boards of, like, Google and Facebook and at senior leadership level, because I truly believe that having those voices in those rooms can make positive changes within those companies.
Well, I hope so. Sometimes you get people in those positions and all of a sudden they're like, I want to help myself and myself only. Like, it wasn't as if Margaret Thatcher was a boon for feminism, was she? So that's a very depressing note to end on. I wanted to leave it on a positive note to end on.
What kind of tangent is this?
No, it's just that, you know, I've heard it said that sometimes, you know, you don't necessarily just want black faces in high places when they're not necessarily going to do anything for those that are behind them in that sense.
Well, let's get them there first and then we can judge.
Then we can
let's get them there first and then we can judge.
Real talk.
What do you think about the fact that many, like, young people, so people who are still, like, in the first maybe 7 years of their career within tech, find themselves in a position where, because of how tech works and particularly startups, they've never really worked at a single company longer than a year. And maybe they even find themselves in a situation like I saw the other day where they've worked at a company for 5 weeks and then they realize that the environment is super toxic.
Who's this?
The runway is really low. Name redacted.
Okay, cool.
And they were like, you know, I need to quit. But is that going to look bad when I then go around to the next company and go, oh yeah, I left after 5 weeks? What do you think about that? People who often find themselves in a position where they can't really stay at the startup much longer, or things at the startup change and that forces them out.
I mean, that's two different scenarios. Someone that's working for 1 or 2 years.
Does it look bad is the question.
Oh, does it look bad? I mean, if that was my friend and they came to me and said, listen, I've worked somewhere for 5 weeks, I'd be like, leave it off the CV.
That's what I'd say too.
Yeah, leave it off the CV. Let's keep it 100. Just leave it off the CV, just as a personal, you know, advice that I would give to a friend that I would care about. But in terms of the whole, I'm not sure what the question is.
The question is basically like, does it look bad? You're a founder. Would that stop you from hiring someone? And like, what advice can you give someone based on your own experiences? I'll just like share a little note on this. I think from my own experiences, it doesn't look bad if you can have a good story to tell. And like you said, leaving 5 weeks at a startup off of your CV means you don't have to tell that story.
I think the startup world is different in the sense that the life cycle of a company is getting shorter. So if somebody came to me with a CV and they'd already been somewhere for 1 to 2 years, I would know what to expect. I think it would put me off training somebody up though. If I had to train somebody up, I would be like, okay, you know, you're not coming necessarily job ready, so I have to invest some time and resources into you. And if you're going to up and leave after 1 year, that may be a downer. But if it's like a ready-made role and they're qualified, I don't think it would. I think I would just expect it. And I would be a hypocrite to judge someone for that, because I've done that myself. I've worked in places for less than a year and left, you know, and then just fudged the numbers on my CV, keeping it 100.
It's really interesting. I think the average tenure at Amazon is 11 months or 12 months. At least it was when I worked there. It's very short. But their argument is that really, really smart people get bored easily and are always being hunted by other companies.
Mm.
So, but, we also only want to work with those people ideally. So in their view, it's worth having the best people, even if it's only for a year, than having the average people for years and years and years, which I think is really interesting.
It's also because like talent is in demand right now. If you know what you're doing with like, you know, AI, machine learning, or like even if you're like, you know, someone who doesn't work in the technical side of it, but you have an understanding of technology, you have a choice of wherever you want to work, and recruiters are hitting you up in your DM. Like,
yes,
you know, I said to a friend of mine, this is very politically incorrect, but like when you're a developer on LinkedIn, it's like being an attractive woman. Like your DMs are just constantly full up with recruiters. Like, yeah, can we talk to you? And it's like, yeah, your head does get turned.
Yeah.
Like, and you are probably going to see something that's better. And also there's an element of maybe like, you know, it's a quick way of getting a pay rise. Yeah. Just going somewhere new instead of having to negotiate a pay rise, which is maybe, you know, a difficult conversation to have, which not everybody is confident enough to do it.
I just, I agree. I think in tech, but just in the world in general, that the attitudes toward careers is changing. And just because you've been somewhere for X period of time does not necessarily mean that you were good or that it was good or that you learned anything, that you're high value. Exactly. And so like, you know, if you find yourself in that position where you're like, I just want to leave, but you know, I'm worried it's too soon. Like your life is more important than the time you spend in a company. That's my perspective. Like anytime it's got to a point where I'm just like, I'm over this.
Mm.
I've just left, and it's never held me back because I've always had like a justification for why I did what I did.
Mm.
You know, sometimes you're hired into a role and then the role changes and sometimes it changes into something that's exciting for you and you know, uses the skills you want to develop. Sometimes it changes into something which is boring to you and uses skills that you learned time ago and you don't want to do that anymore. I think as long as you are confident in, you know, your narrative, your story that you're telling, and as long as you're like nice to get along with and can do some things very, very well, it really doesn't matter.
You know, you will probably have some experience in this. My hunch has always been that the worst position that you could take is to be a business development person within a really nascent startup that maybe is like pivoting all the time. Because I've seen it firsthand in the ones that I've worked in, where like all of a sudden the business model changes and like what that person has been grinding and working on, all of a sudden doesn't make a difference anymore and we're doing something completely different. And I've seen people just churn out and just leave because they're like, you know what? I don't know what we're doing here. I'd rather go somewhere where it's more stable.
Mm.
I don't know. Have you had, because you kind of work biz dev type stuff in the past?
I mean, that's a really good point. It actually like kind of like strikes a chord with me because I used to work for a travel startup and I like launched the app in new markets and I negotiated like terms of the deals. Basically the way most travel agencies work is, you know, you sell like a hotel room or a flight or whatever, and you take X percent of that sale, and that's your commission, that's your revenue. And I'd basically negotiated specific commission percentages with all of the new clients that I signed, locked them in, you know, on a promise to then uphold that commission for however many months. Then like the funding round didn't close, layoffs happened, and suddenly I basically had to like go back on all of those negotiations. and change it. And I was so frustrated because, you know, on the one hand, it's like business, but then on the other hand, like business development is very relationship based and personal.
Completely, yeah.
It basically comes down to like, can we be mates?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, let's talk as mates. At least that's how I do it.
Yeah.
And I'm really, really, really don't believe in being dishonest. Like yeah. I had colleagues that would be like, oh, just promise them everything. And then like later down the line, just say, it's not your fault, you can't do it. And I was like, hell no, like yeah. never in my life have I done that with sales, because people respect you more when you're honest. Like if people say, can I do this? And you're like, look, I'm going to be real with you. No.
Yeah. And also like, linking into what we're saying about how most people now are not staying at companies for long, your reputation will exceed probably the length of stay at that company. So you've got to run with that. So is anybody going to hire you if they've got
a negative
experience of ABBA? She lied to me to sign this contract. Yeah. Like, and the world is small. Like, no, I don't believe that any relationship is now closed. I feel like you're going to, especially in an industry, you're going to run into people again.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And so word travels. So if you start saying shit like that,
exactly, it's a problem. Then people know. Yeah. So, like, I did not stay at that startup very much longer. I ended up quitting. And funnily enough, like, I mean, I still speak to loads of my clients. Like, one of them liked me so much. He would, like, arrange, like, that I go interview with, like, one of his friends that was in, like, another startup here in London and a bunch of other things. But, yeah, one thing I'll say is, like, the original question was, is it bad, therefore, to be a business development person in an early stage startup? Like, on the one hand, yes, it can be emotionally exhausting to be cold calling that much and then negotiating terms and then suddenly the terms change and it sucks. However, for developing resilience and grit,
yeah, you'll learn a lot.
You will learn a lot. And one of the key ingredients of every great founder is sales skills.
Mm.
And if you feel that you have not developed your sales skills and you want to challenge yourself and you haven't really picked an area of specialty in your career yet, go and try business development. Seriously, any type of growth role, because, you know, engineering is valuable and that's great. But if you're really good at growth, you will get hired anywhere and you will always be an asset to anyone.
Mm.
And that's what I found in my career.
Yeah, if I was like an investor, I would love to back growth people, product people, like business development people. Like that's, I would need somebody on the team that was like that. Just
that's really all you need.
Yeah, I mean, you might. Ideally, you would need an engineer. Yeah, an engineer.
Depending on what the type of product is, a product designer would be amazing. Okay,
this is a question. Like, what would be your dream team? Like, if I said to you,
it depends on what I make.
You got a like software product. I said to you, you're the VC, and just on paper, you like teams of what? How many? Two or three? With what kind of people in there?
So, like in the early stages, if it's just SaaS, I definitely probably just want like a product designer, a salesperson, depending on how complicated the tech is, I could maybe even contract that out.
Mm.
But then eventually I'd need a CTO on board and like a data scientist.
So that's four.
Yes.
You'd want on a founding team.
Yeah. That would be a good
four
mix,
co-founders.
Don't need four co-founders, but yeah, but actually, yeah, why not? Why not? But I would make either, depending on who has like more influence over where things go, one of them's got to be CEO and they'd have to have the greater share.
And who would
of
be the CEO? The salesperson?
I guess it depends who believes in the vision more. I need to know what it is. I need to know what its mission is.
Yeah.
Like if it's like some kind of like B2B, I don't know, CRM tool.
Mm.
I'm thinking of Intercom at the moment, actually, because they just raised a big round of funding. Their CEO, Owen, is a designer by background.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so he's not the CTO, he's a designer. But it's kind of incredible in that sense because it's the design of the product which has got them so far because it had such a different approach to it. So I guess
and so were the Airbnb founder.
Yeah, CEO, Brian Chesky. Yeah,
he's a designer as well. So you can never predict it. So us sitting here like deciding who's the dream team is quite problematic because we don't necessarily. You might be ruling out people that don't fit into that model.
Yeah.
And we might just be replicating the whole VC problem already. But saying that, I would do my dream team. I think I would need one like developer, engineer, CTO type person. I think outsourcing tech at that stage is you can burn so much money. And then I would need product visionary, product manager, product designer type person. Ideally, they would be the CEO. Like I've worked under CEOs that are not necessarily designers per se, but they have an eye for design that is just amazing and they just know product so well.
Yeah.
And then maybe an out and out salesperson. I wouldn't have a data person because there probably won't be a lot of data at that stage.
Yeah.
So like a salesperson, a product visionary, and a technical person, that would be the ideal dream team.
I think I need to do a bit more research, but I think I'd like to see more companies who have, like tech companies, sorry, who have like growth CEOs. So CEOs whose previous roles were sales or marketing or whatever.
Mm.
I can't think of any.
Okay, we'll come back to it next week.
I'll do some research.
I think we'll call it a day then.
Cool.
Yeah, we'll leave it there. So anything you want to shout out?
Just thanks to everyone who's been giving us feedback on Twitter, social media, sharing it, giving us reviews on iTunes, giving us reviews on SoundCloud. If you haven't done it yet, please do. We're so grateful.
Yeah, and keep using the hashtag Techish. The debate continues on there. We'll get back to everybody and try to chime in if you've got any questions about what we said. Leave your reviews, leave your comments. And yeah, we'll catch you next week.
Bye.
Ciao.